Manny has to work very hard to remind himself to call her Padmini, however, because, of course, her name in his head is Queen's. But that is a name she must choose. He has no right to force it upon her. Brooklyn smiles at the girl wearily.
I call things like I see them, but you're right. Fungus isn't where I wanted to go either.
Speaking of other things I don't want to hear but that do have to be said, this thing came directly at Manny and me, but attacked a neighbor in your case. Any idea why?
Why are you asking me?
Padmini looks aggrieved. She starts to wring out her hair again. It's actually dry, but the gesture has the look of a nervous tick.
Before what, 3 or 4 hours ago? I didn't know about any of this.
They have, by this point, explained everything to her that they can. It's gone more smoothly than Manny expected, probably because Padmini just saw a pool try to eat 2 children. It's been awkward, too, however, because Padmini's relative, the older woman, whom Padmini has introduced as Eshwara Aunty, has come down to see why Padmini apparently ran out of their apartment at full tilt and then teleported to the neighbor's backyard. Auntie hasn't said much, but she's hovering and radiating protectiveness in a way that Manny would admire if so many of her hostile glares weren't directed at him and Brooklyn. But he knows the answer to Brooklyn's question, so he decides to interject.
Going after collaterals is good strategy, he says, as he slides his hands into his pockets. Family, neighbors, co-workers, anyone who isn't capable of defending themselves. Start some kind of high-profile chaos involving people the target cares about, which might both lure her out of a safe position and distract her with worry or grief, then attack while she's off guard.
He's abruptly aware that Brooklyn has narrowed her eyes at him. He knows why. There's just nothing he can do about it. Her voice is neutral, though, when she speaks.
How is she in a safe position beforehand?
Yes. How?
That's from Eshwara Aunty, who looks like a taller 40-something version of the Avatar of Queens and is pretty regal herself in a gloriously sunset orange-themed cotton sari.
If you aren't just crazy.
Padmini tries to hush her. Manny turns to point at Padmini's apartment building. It's an ordinary-looking wooden frame house, 4 stories high. She's told them she lives on the top floor with Eshwara and Eshwara's husband and their new baby.
That building, Manny says.
It's glowing, isn't it?
We all see that.
Brooklyn turns to look, and Padmini gasps. Glowing isn't exactly the word for what they're seeing, Manny suspects. But it's close enough. The sun has slanted towards sunset, backlighting the building in a way that would be eerie if this were Amityville instead of Jackson Heights. That's not what Manny wants them to notice. What he hopes they see, and what all of them except Eshwara clearly do, is that Padmini's building is different from Mrs. Yu's and from every building around it. Brighter, somehow, more defined. Almost as if the building has been photoshopped for greater sharpness while the rest of the block retains a fuzzier contrast. Somehow, that building is right in a way that the checker cab had been, now that Manny thinks about it, and his own apartment building once he'd stepped off the elevator. He noticed the change at the time, but he hadn't understood it.
I don't think the enemy can get into that building, Manny says. Something has made it more Queens, so to speak, than the rest of Queens.
You're saying I did that? Padmini shakes her head. I didn't do anything. Until you two showed up, I had no idea why any of this was happening. Why would I be able to?
She gestures at her building in frustration.
I don't know, but I wish you could tell us how you did it.
This thing is targeting us one by one, and I don't think it's going to stop.
There doesn't seem to be an instruction manual or a wise old mentor anywhere to help us figure out the rules. But if we keep playing catch-up, it's going to win eventually.
Manny sighs and rubs a hand over his face, suddenly very tired. It's been a long day.
Between them is a little plate of baozi that Mrs. Yu put out for them, and he bends to take one, suddenly ravenous. It's delicious. He takes another.
Brooklyn sighs as well.
Look, I'm one out, and I missed lunch riding up to Inwood to save this one from the feather monster.
She jabs a thumb at Manny.
I think we need to rethink trying to do this all at once. Not going to do anybody any good if we drop where we stand.
Shouldn't we go to the Bronx? Manny frowns. Since we know who she is, and, what's the fifth borough again? I forgot, sorry.
Staten Island, Brooklyn says. I have no idea how to find her, though.
Who?
Asks Padmini.
Brooklyn blinks. Huh. I don't know where that came from.
It feels right, though, doesn't it? She looks at each of them.
Padmini frowns and nods slowly. Manny does, too.
Well, okay, then.
Brooklyn shakes her head, plainly uneasy about the strange knowledge dropping into her head.
My point was that that woman has probably already gone after the Bronx and Staten Island, same as she did all of us. And the fact that those boroughs haven't exploded or something means that the people who represent them have figured out enough to survive so far. They're probably confused as hell, but they may not need our help any more than she did.
Brooklyn nods toward Padmini.
I am certainly confused,
Aishwara Auntie mutters. Padmini pulls her to sit down on the step beside her, and they start having a hastily muttered conversation in some other language. Tamil, Manny knows. He knows so many things that he should not.
There's another of us, he blurts.
When they all look at him, Aishwara with narrowed eyes, he explains.
Not five, but six.
The woman in white. She kept going on about another. Someone who'd fought her, beaten her, but not completely. That's why she's still able to attack us.
Six, Brooklyn frowns.
She's been staring at the baozi, and now finally gives in to temptation, taking the last one. Almost immediately, the door behind them cracks open, and Mrs. Yu puts out another plate of three. Manny nods to her awkwardly, but she doesn't bother looking at them before closing the door again. Meanwhile, Brooklyn continues.
Ain't but five boroughs, Manny.
Five shapes that fit together make one whole,
Padmini says, shrugging. Manny blinks in confusion, but Brooklyn inhales.
You mean the city as a whole, she says, her eyes widening. Not a borough at all, but New York. The city of New York all in one person.
Who? She says, shaking her head. But it's clear that she believes it. Manny does too, now that the concept exists in his mind.
He must be all kinds of crazy.
But strong. Manny murmurs. A shiver passes through him. The hairs on the back of his neck prickle. Why? He doesn't know. But he does not want to question his assessment or Brooklyn's assumption that the embodiment of New York is male.
If he fought whatever it was that took out the bridge by himself, we need him.
Padmini slowly holds up a hand.
Then if we are voting, I vote with Miss Brooklyn. You both look exhausted. I feel exhausted. It will be dark soon, and I would like very much to have some time to think about all this. Maybe we could adjourn for the night and reconvene in the morning?
That's foolish, snaps Aishwara Auntie.
They all stare at her, and her scowl deepens.
You just said something was hunting you. You want to split up now and make it easier to pick you off? Together, you can at least watch one another's backs.
Auntie, you believe us?
Padmini asks. She looks wide-eyed, hopeful, and very young.
Eshwara shrugs. Doesn't matter if I do or not. Craziness is happening. So let's figure out a way to get done with the craziness quickly, so you can get back to your life. Yes?
Padmini laughs a little, but Manny sees the gratitude in her eyes. Brooklyn sighs.
I have to get back anyway. I told my daughter I'd be late, but I don't want to be out all damn night trying to hunt down borough people and city people, especially when we have no idea where to start with two of those.
Manny feels the same, but some of that is the general jangling restlessness that he's been feeling since Padmini mentioned an overall embodiment of the city. They need each other, he feels certain, but they especially need this sixth one. And he feels especially, instinctively certain that they need to hurry up on that last bit.
This must be happening in other cities, Padmini says, interrupting Manny's reverie.
She's scowling, as if annoyed that the world makes less sense today than it did the day before.
We can't be the only weird ones, can we? Have there been disasters like the bridge anywhere else today?
No, says Eshwara.
She sighs.
The usual bad news everywhere, but nothing like the bridge.
Then Manny remembers. The woman said something about Sao Paulo being here with the person who is New York.
The city of Sao Paulo?
Brooklyn asks.
It has a person? Shouldn't that person be in Sao Paulo? I don't know. But if it's true, then what's happening to us is something that must have already happened in that city. And that settles something I've been thinking about since you brought it up.
He nods to Brooklyn.
When you said that we can leave and the city will pick someone else.
I think you're right about that. It feels right. And that's pretty much all we've had to go on so far.
But I also feel like, past a certain point, we are no longer going to have that choice.
The whole city is probably supposed to be like Padmini's building, safe from the woman in white. It isn't. Not just because we don't know what we're doing, but because something's wrong right now. We're incomplete without each other and the one who is New York. We can't secure the whole city, but if we ever manage to do that,
Brooklyn groans. I get it. Then we'll be like Sao Paulo. Wherever we go, even if it isn't New York, we'll be New York.
Padmini sits up looking alarmed.
What, forever? But no.
They all look at her in surprise, even Eshwara. Padmini grimaces.
It's just, look, this is a lot to deal with. It's nice that both of you have come to help, but
she shakes her head, a coronal rather than a lateral movement, conveying her struggle to articulate the problem.
I don't know. I can't become Queens. I'm not even a U.S. citizen. What if my internship company doesn't hire me and I can't find another job that will give me a visa? Then I'll be puttering around Chennai being Queens. That can't be right.
They all stare at each other in uncomfortable silence. Mrs. Yu opens the door again, just enough that they can see half her face. Manny's getting used to ignoring her. She's obviously eavesdropping. But that's also just part of life in a city. She doesn't put another plate out this time, however, just peering out at them through the slit between door and frame. Her gaze roams them all and lands on Manny.
You hua xiao? She asks.
Hapa? That's what the young people call it now.
Manny blinks out of trying to understand why he understands Tui Shanese.
No.
Not that he knows of. She examines them all again, then presses her lips together in annoyance.
In China, many cities have gods of their walls. Fortune aids them. It's normal. Relax.
Okay, what the fuck?
Brooklyn says.
Yes, exactly,
says Aishwara. Padmini frowns at her.
There are many in my country who believe that too. Lots of stories, lots of gods, lots of avatars, probably hundreds. Some are patrons of cities. You could call them city gods. It's wild to think you're one.
She glares at Padmini, whose expression takes on a sort of aggrieved blankness, an old habit of tactful silence, Manny guesses.
But if you are, then you are.
Yes.
Mrs. Yu opens the door more. Behind her, on one of the apartment's couches, her younger grandson is asleep. His brother sits nearby reading a school textbook as if they did not just fight for their lives that afternoon.
Real gods aren't what most of you Christians think of as gods. Gods are people. Sometimes dead people, sometimes still alive, sometimes never lived.
She shrugs.
They do jobs. Bring fortune, look after people, make sure the world works as it should. They fall in love, have babies, fight, die.
She shrugs.
It's duty. It's normal. Get over it.
And there's really not much they can say to this. Brooklyn's expression softens.
Sorry, ma'am. We've been here for a while. We should get out of your hair, shouldn't we?
You saved my grandson's lives. But yes.
So they get up and file out, which necessitates going through Mrs. Yu's house. Manny takes care to thank her for the dumplings. Aishwara stops on the sidewalk outside, glaring at them as if they have personally conspired to trouble her.
You both will have to stay with us,
she tells Brooklyn and Manny.
If our building is a safe place, and if having you around makes Padmini safer. I don't have any clothes to fit you, and there's only the floor.
My apartment building will work too, Manny says, then he grimaces. But it might be the final straw for my roommate. Brooklyn, however, is shaking her head.
I've got a place that should do, actually, if this whole business works the way I think it does. More than enough room for all of us. Hang on.
And she takes out her phone again, turning away from them to begin dialing. Manny wonders if she's asking her aides to create some kind of safe house for half-apotheosized cities to hide out in. Padmini is staring at him oddly, though, and he raises his eyebrows.
What? I thought you were a little Punjabi, maybe, until I heard what Mrs. Yu said.
What are you, then?
Black.
It comes out instinctively and feels true.
You look off-white.
Nope. Black.
Black Latino, or maybe black Jewish, or what is it, Creole?
Plain old ordinary black.
It feels like a familiar conversation. He has gotten this a lot throughout his life.
I mean, probably other stuff besides black somewhere back down the line. But I don't remember if I ever knew what or cared.
He shrugs.
America.
She chuckles at this. Aishwara is watching Brooklyn. Padmini seems to relax a little amid this reprieve from her auntie's disapproval.
Queens, the borough, I mean, looks like you too.
So many shades of what are you, brown? But she inhales with a little ah.
Manhattan has Harlem, and Central Park used to be a black and Irish neighborhood. I read about that online somewhere. They took the land from those families to make the park. And there's that memorial downtown at Wall Street where they found a bunch of Africans buried in unmarked graves. Slaves. I guess some were free. But there were thousands of them, all buried under...
She grimaces.
Where I work.
So, what Manhattan is now?
White people run so much of it, but it's literally built on the bones of black people. And Native Americans, and Chinese, and Latinos, and whole waves of European immigrants and...
everybody.
That must be why you look so...
everything.
Okay.
Manny focuses on what's more interesting.
You work on Wall Street?
At this, she slumps a little, looking disgruntled.
It isn't my fault. I'm not a citizen. To get a work visa after graduation, my best chance is an internship with a company that can afford to pay the fees. And right now, only finance and tech.
Whoa, it's okay. I'm sorry.
Manny holds up his hands quickly.
I don't judge.
I do.
Padmini's expression settles into anger.
My employer does terrible things. I can't think about it or I won't sleep at night. Oh, I hate this city. That's the irony of this whole affair. Me? Part of New York? That is bullshit. Such bullshit. But I've lived here for like a third of my life, and my family's hopes are all tied up in me being successful here, so I can't leave it either.
And that, Manny understands, is why she has become Queens. Brooklyn turns, tucking her phone into her purse.
I just let my father know we're on the way. Everything is set up. Ready?
Ishwara purses her lips, reluctantly impressed by such efficiency. She eyes Padmini.
I assume you've decided to go with them.
Yes, that seems best. And I'm not going to get up to wild orgies or anything, I promise.
Just make sure your orgy partners are U.S. citizens, free of bad diseases, and not too old or ugly. You had better get some clothes to take with you, Kunju.
Oh, right.
Padmini smiles gamely at Manny and Brooklyn, then starts toward her building. She stops, however, frowning as Manny and Brooklyn move to follow.
I'll only be 5 minutes.
The woman in white could kill you in 5 minutes, Manny says, or us, for that matter.
Padmini stares, and then probably thinks about Mrs. Yu's pool.
Fine, then,
she says, and they all follow her inside.
It takes longer than 5 minutes.
That's because, as soon as Padmini opens the front yard's gate, the garden apartment's window slides up, and a tiny old white woman peers out at them.
Padmini, was that you screaming?
She demands of Padmini. And Padmini goes over to crouch by the window and explain that, yes, she screamed, but it was because there was a horribly big cockroach in Mrs. Yu's pool. And she just happened to be over visiting, and she really, really hates cockroaches. That seems to mollify the old woman, who mentions that she's baking some pies and will bring one up to Padmini's apartment when she's done.
Sorry,
Padmini says, looking sheepish as they move on from this.
Miss Kennerick does make extremely good pie,
Aishwara says to Brooklyn and Manny in an aside.
My husband eats them like a pig.
After they climb the steps and go inside the building, it happens again. Each of the floors has been split into two small apartments. The 1A tenant is a young man whose dog they can hear barking through the door before he cracks it open, with the chain still in place. He eyes Brooklyn and Manny for a moment, then asks in a low voice if Padmini is having any trouble. Padmini beams and assures him that she's fine, and the new people are friends and everything's well. So the young man mutters an order, and the dog, a very large pit bull, goes silent. Both of them continue glaring, however, until Manny and Brooklyn are out of sight.
That was just Tony, Padmini says as they climb the steps. He's very nice. He makes me black cake in December with rum, and I get so tipsy. He must be a freelancer, because he's home all day, which is why I suppose he's such a good cook. I don't know what he does for a living.
I do,
Brooklyn says with a grin at Manny. It's like that all the way up. They don't meet 1B or 2A, both of whom are at work, according to Padmini, but 2B is rented by a stoop-shouldered older black man in a kufi, who thanks Padmini for looking after his cat the week before. When she shyly asks for a few sticks of incense, he beams and hands her some from a shelf near the door.
I always light this scent for when I pray, he says,
clearly approving of her newly remembered spirituality.
Her? Pray?
Mutters Aishwara. But the man in the kufi doesn't hear.
I do too pray,
snaps Padmini, but she blushes a little and hurries on up. The whole third floor is one family, relatives of the owner, Padmini says. The door doesn't open, but Manny can hear small children inside playing. One of them gets close to the door and yells,
It's Padmini! I hear her! I want to say hi to Padmini!
Before someone else inside the house shushes him and moves him away from the door. And somewhere between the third floor and the fourth, where Padmini lives in Ishwara's place, Manny gets it. This is just one building amid thousands in Jackson Heights. But here in this four-story walk-up is a microcosm of Queens itself. People, cultures, moving in and forming communities and moving on endlessly. In such a place, nurtured by the presence and care of its avatar, the borough's power has permeated every board and cinder block of the building, making it stronger and safer, even as the city as a whole totters, weakened, against its enemy's onslaught. It makes Manny ache suddenly, to feel the same wholeness all over the city. Shouldn't everyone here have this? He's been here only a day, and already he's met so many vividly interesting people, seen so much beautiful strangeness. He wants to protect a city that produces such experiences. He wants to help it grow stronger. He wants to stand at its side and be true. There is a kind of ringing that sounds suddenly through his soul. He stops in the middle of climbing the steps, startled. And Brooklyn turns as well, inhaling a little. Padmini, facing the opposite direction on the next landing to lead them up, stops and shuts her eyes for a moment. He feels the reverberation between them, and it shakes him into the other space, where, for the first time, he realizes that he has never been there as a man. He's a city. When he stares at the strange, empty streets, the damage, mostly healed now because they are growing stronger, the wavering, beautiful light, it suddenly strikes him that this is the equivalent of looking at his own navel. And in the instant that he makes this connection, his perception reels and rises and pulls back until suddenly he sees the whole of himself. He is Manhattan. And in the near distance, barely dwarfed by his own skyscrapers, another. She is Brooklyn. And beside her, close enough to join hands, sprawls a new marvel. Padmini is enormous. Endless miles of low-story sprawl. When she turns, he hears the melodies of 1,000 different instruments, sees the faceted sparkle of stained glass and industrial fiberglass and occasional specks of diamond, tastes salt and bitter earth and sharp, fiery spices that bring tears to his eyes. Right there, his other selves, the city they need to be. He lifts his hands in the other world, the world of tiny people. And through the pounding of his own pulse, he becomes aware of them doing the same. Yes, like this, together. They can be so very strong if they just... All at once, Manny's perception snaps back into his flesh and blood body. He stumbles on the steps and falls, clumsily enough to faceplant on a riser. Blood floods his mouth. A solid 10 seconds pass before Brooklyn and Padmini react. Aishwara beats them both to it, gasping and trotting down the steps to help him sit up before the other two do the same. It's taken that long for Manny to figure out why he's on his face.
What did you expect?
Laughs something, not quite a voice, in his head. It's a good-natured laugh, not the malicious kind. Laughing with, not at.
You're not New York. You're Manhattan. Nice try, but pulling everyone together is his job, not yours.
Abruptly, he is somewhere else. Somewhere in normal New York, down underground? It's dark. He glimpses white tile walls shaded with shadow, a gray concrete floor, a subway station. Smell of dust and a whiff of ozone, oddly clean of the ambience of stale urine that Manny remembers from his one experience of the subway. Somewhere nearby, but not too nearby, a train rumbles past. In the shadows cast by a shaft of sunlight coming from somewhere above, pedestrians hurry past one another, and before him, on a bed of ancient newspapers, curls a sleeping young man. Manny stares down at him, transfixed. The young man is a slight figure, painfully thin, dressed in dirty jeans and worn old sneakers, his gangly-looking limbs sprawled a bit in repose. Manny cannot see his face clearly, though he is bathed in the mottled light from above. Something about the shadows, the angle. He wills himself closer, suddenly aching to see more, but nothing happens. It isn't enough, this mere glimpse. He needs... I'm his, he thinks suddenly, wildly. I want to be... Oh, God. I want to be his. I live for him and will die for him if he requires it. And oh, yes, I'll kill for him, too. He needs that. And so for him and him alone, I will be again the monster that I am. Blink. The vision is gone. Manny finds himself sitting on the stairs again, the others around him, his mouth still full of blood, his mind blank. Padmini and Brooklyn have sat down too, both dazed. Brooklyn glances up at him, and her expression tightens minutely in a way that Manny cannot read. A politician's poker face. You saw him, she says, not a question. So there really is a sixth. New York. Yes. Manny swallows and nods, tonguing his bottom lip where his teeth have cut it. His nose is bleeding, too. He hears the shakiness of his own voice. It's a good match for how he's feeling all over. So, visions. That's new. Group visions, yeah. Brooklyn takes a slow breath. She sounds a little shaky, too. I'd say it was all in your head, but apparently it's in mine, too. Manny nods unhappily. And mine, says Padmini. Ishwara is sitting near her now, but Padmini is still managing to look wobbly on her step. Do either of you know where that was? I've only been here one day, Manny says. He pushes himself up a bit more and pinches his nose shut, tilting his head back. Brooklyn shakes her head too, however. Not a clue. That is not Brooklyn, though. What? Because the vision came to Manny most powerfully. Oh. Describe it, Ishwara says, frowning at him. He shakes his head, too out of it to marshal his thoughts. Padmini speaks for him, and as she does so, he marvels at the clarity with which she has seen into his mind.
We were somewhere underground. A subway station, but a strange one. Dark, except there was sunlight. And there was a boy lying on some newspapers.
Young, but not a child. Early 20s, Manny would guess. Black, dark-skinned, lean, probably quick when he moves.
Newspapers?
Ishwara looks from Padmini to the rest of them, her eyes wide, like a puppy or something.
No, like a bed.
Brooklyn rubs her eyes, then gets to her feet.
Stacks of papers, some still with the straps on. He was lying on a bed of newspapers, somewhere in a disused portion of some subway station.
Which narrows it down to, oh, like 20 possible places. Hell, every now and again, we find tunnels we forgot over the years, so he might be in one of those. And I don't even know what the hell this is about.
She's watching Manny closely.
I get the sense you do, though.
D-
Do you want to go to the hospital? I can call a rideshare.
Padmini has found a tissue somewhere on her person and is ineffectually trying to dab at Manny's nose. He takes it from her and swabs the blood off his face.
No, he says. Thanks. This'll stop in a minute.
You hit that step hard. What if it's broken?
Not my first broken nose, if so.
Manny shifts his attention over to Brooklyn.
I don't know anything more than you do.
I think I saw him. We saw him. Because there are three of us here. If we want to see more, more of us need to be together.
The Bronx or Staten Island. Or maybe all of them will need to be together before the knowledge of where the sixth one, the true New York, lights up in their minds like a here there be dragons pointer.
Brooklyn says nothing for a moment. Then she murmurs to Padmini,
go on up and get your stuff, baby. We'll catch a lift or something, but still, best to travel light.
Oh, right. Padmini gets to her feet with Aishwara's help, and they hurry on up the stairs. When the door to their apartment has closed, Brooklyn shifts to sit on the stair above Manny.
You remember more about who you used to be? She asks. It's casual.
He checks his nose, seems unbroken. The bleeding has slowed too.
Some.
It's casual. She purses her lips.
I got a little more from that vision than just that boy. New York, I mean. I think I picked up on some of you.
Yes, he rather suspected that she had. Padmini doesn't seem to have, but maybe she's dealing with so much strangeness that this is just more of the same. He waits for Brooklyn to make her point.
When did you start remembering? I don't, not really.
Some of that, however, is because he does not want to remember. His real name is on his ID, for example, but he has kept himself from looking closely at it. There are contacts in his phone that he isn't interested in calling, texts he does not mean to answer. These are choices, he understands, as meaningful as his choice to remain in the city rather than fleeing on the next train to God knows where. He can be who he was if he wants to be, but only up to a point. Something about the old him is incompatible with the new identity that the city wants him to have. So he has chosen to be Manhattan, whatever that might cost.
Brooklyn says, noncommittal, leaving him space. Manny's tired. It's been a long day. I used to hurt people, he says, sitting back against the stairwell wall and gazing into the middle distance between them. That's what you want to know, isn't it? I don't remember everything. I don't remember why, but I remember that much. Sometimes I did it physically. More often, I just scared them into doing what I needed them to do. But for a threat to have any teeth, sometimes I followed through. I was good at it. Efficient. But I made the choice not to be that person anymore. I remember that in particular. That's why most people leave their old lives and come to the big city, right? New start, new self. It's just turning out to be a little more literal for me than for most people.
She says, taking a deep breath.
Serial killer?
No. He doesn't remember feeling pleasure in the things he did. But he does remember that causing pain and fear was as easy for him as terrorizing Martha Blemons had been in the park. Meaningless. He's not sure that's any better than being a serial killer.
It was a job, I think. I did it for power. And maybe money.
But somewhere along the way, he'd chosen to stop. He clings to this proof of his humanity as if it is the only thing that matters, because it is.
Well, that's pretty damn fitting for Manhattan. He can feel the weight of her gaze. You've got some weird feelings about that young man. Manny sighs a little. He'd been hoping she hadn't gotten that too. Some things should remain private for God's sake. Sorry, she says. I wasn't exactly expecting to get yanked into, I don't know, a Vulcan mind meld or whatever. So I didn't think to, not look. Hope you didn't get any of me. I don't think so. Good. She folds her arms and leans on her knees. Her legs are primly aligned, her skirt not at all rucked up. She is the picture of elegance in this ugly wood-paneled old stairway. But that's worry on her elegant face. So, between us, I'm getting a bad feeling about what happens if and when all six of us finally get together. If that was a taste of it. I don't think I want five other people in my head. Manny shrugs. He doesn't either. But it's becoming increasingly clear that they must find one another or die. Maybe it won't be so bad when we find the New York. Maybe he'll regulate it or something. You're very optimistic for a possible serial killer. I like that about you. It makes him laugh, which he apparently needed, because he feels so much better. How are you doing with all this, apart from existential dread? She shrugs, but he's good at reading people. It must have been a professional skill for him once. She's terrified, in her quietly elegant way. I'd think about leaving. Not that I want to, of course. New York is my home. Fought for this city all my life. But just to keep my father and my daughter out of the line of fire, you know? I'm doing this instead for now. Because seeing this through offers a possibility for both. Help the city and keep my family safe. But if things get too tight, she shrugs eloquently. Not sure I love New York enough to die for it. Definitely don't love it enough to sacrifice my family for it. You said your daughter was 14? Yep. Can nobody tell her nothing. Brooklyn relaxes visibly with the change of subject and smiles with fond exasperation. Dad says she's payback for all my lip when I was her age. But she's got a good head on her shoulders, too. Just like her mama. Manny chuckles. He can't remember whether he was mouthy growing up. But it's nice to imagine that he might have been. Anything I can do to help your family, I will. Her expression softens. Maybe she likes him a little more. And I hope you get to become the person you actually want to be, she says, which makes him blank. This city will eat you alive, you know, if you let it. Don't. Then she gets up, because Padmini is coming out of her apartment, still trying to stuff things into a backpack, while Aishwara hands her things she's forgotten and bags of food. Brooklyn moves to help. While the women murmur and work together on getting the pack zipped, Manny chews on Brooklyn's words. They feel like a warning of many things. Then the women come down, and he gets up to take any baggage that Padmini will let him carry, which isn't much, though Aishwara readily plonks two filled reusable grocery bags on his arms and a tiffin stack into his hands. Ready, Padmini says, looking at them anxiously, and I have dinner for us, if you want. Also, I called my supervisor and let him know I won't be able to come in to my internship for the next few days. I now have the flu. You get a cough with the flu, don't you? Sometimes, says Manny, fighting a smile. Oh, well, I did mention a fever of 110, and that I had my period too. He'll think I'm delirious from one or the other.
Get well soon.
Brooklyn says dryly.
Let's go, then.
They catch a lift that carries them along the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway. The nighttime cityscape of Manhattan is perfectly positioned for Manny to stare at for most of the drive. And he does so greedily, fascinated, despite the knowledge that he is staring at himself. He's a little overwhelmed by all of it. The bright, startling order of the highway, even as half of its drivers seem determined to run their own private speed races. The high-rises that loom over or alongside the highway, and the fleeting vignette glimpses he gets into other people's lives. A couple arguing in front of an ugly painting of a boat. A room full of people, which must be a dinner party. An old man pointing a remote at a TV with both hands and yelling. At one point, their highway runs between two other highways, underneath a third, and alongside a service road that's actually bigger. It's madness. It's amazing. It's nothing more than what any large city has, and yet it is more. Manny feels the pomp and life of it. When he rolls down the window, he sticks his face out as much as the seatbelt allows and inhales the rushing air. The driver gives him a skeptical look, but shrugs and says nothing. He lets this breath out, and the wind gusts hard enough to shake the car a little, making the driver curse and Brooklyn clap a hand over her hair to keep it from being too messed up by the open window. She throws him a warning look, knowing full well what he's up to, and he smiles back apologetically. He can't help it, though. He is falling in love with a city. And men in love are not always considerate or wise. When they arrive at the address Brooklyn has given the driver, it's deep in a neighborhood that the map calls Bedford-Stuyvesant. They emerge from the car to face a pair of brownstones, stately, narrow things, which seem to have been similarly renovated and decorated. One is still in the traditional style, with an ironwork gate opening onto a stoop of steps. There's even a historical landmark plaque beside its first floor door. The other, however, has been modified. No steps, no gate, and the garden apartment door opens directly onto a pretty brick-lined and plant-strewn courtyard. The arched double-door entryway is much wider than that of the other brownstone, and its doors are more modern. Manny spots an automatic door opener button to one side. Padmini whistles.
"Ooh, this is very rich," she says, admiring the building. Then to Brooklyn, "You're very rich."
Brooklyn snorts, although she also stops on the sidewalk to let them gawk, plainly enjoying their admiration. And Manny notes, she doesn't deny the rich part.
"We'll be staying there,"
she says, nodding to the traditional brownstone, "unless either of you have issues with steps. My family lives in the accessible one. Dad uses a wheelchair. You'll get a little 14-year-old attitude from my daughter, but if you don't mind that, we can all crash there, too."
"I'd love to meet your family, but steps are fine," Manny says. Padmini agrees, so Brooklyn leads them up the steps of the traditional brownstone. Inside, Padmini's very rich gets compounded with and stylish.
Someone's renovated the place. Original details like a fireplace with a marble mantel and a carpeted mahogany-banistered stairwell have been joined by a modernist chandelier that looks like a frozen explosion and trendy furniture that's too visually striking to be entirely comfortable. Manny likes it anyway. And best of all, the instant they walk inside the building, Manny feels a skin-shivering return of the sensation they felt in Padmini's and his own apartment buildings. The architectural lines look sharper, the walls texture finer. The light brightens just a touch. The room smells fresher.
"Yeah, thought so," Brooklyn says, grinning. "Ain't nothing more Brooklyn than a brownstone, baby."
"Are you in real estate?"
Padmini asks, still a bit wide-eyed.
Not really. Only own these two buildings. I grew up here, see?
Brooklyn sighs as she slips her shoes off. Manny and Padmini quickly follow suit.
Dad bought both buildings in the 70s. Just 60 grand for this whole entire building. The city was struggling in those days. White people ran off to the suburbs because they didn't want their kids going to school alongside little Jose and Jaquita. So the same bad economy that hit everywhere else did double damage here. But Dad held on to the buildings, even when the property taxes nearly ate us alive. When I was 14, I was snaking toilets and moving furniture. JoJo don't know how good she's got it.
Your daughter? Asks Padmini.
Right. Short for Josephine. Named her after Baker.
Brooklyn shakes her head, then grins.
Anyway, now both buildings are worth millions.
She grins and beckons for them to follow as she starts giving them a tour. Just managed to finish the accessibility mods to the other building before the whole block went historic landmark, thank God. Or I'd still be in a paperwork fight with the city. And I still had to promise to never modify this one, to soothe all the ruffled feathers.
People had a problem with you making a brownstone that a wheelchair user could live in?
Welcome to New York.
She gestures to the airy, crown-molding-accented kitchen.
Anyway, we rent this one out to tourists for the extra income.
She shakes her head in amusement.
Historic townhome, city views, vintage accents. 5,000 per unit per month, bam. And more during special events or holiday seasons. Dad calls it the Clyde Thomason Pension Backup Fund, since the city keeps threatening to take them away.
Brooklyn shows them each to a neat little guest room and orders Chinese for dinner. Queens has the meal that Aishwara packed for her. But she nibbles from the fried rice and freely shares the fragrant lamb curry and idlis from her tiffin. It's a humble, quiet supper as they sit around the kitchen island. But it's such a relief to just be able to relax for a while that Manny savors it. He does feel guilt because somewhere in the city, the avatars of the Bronx and Staten Island are alone, possibly afraid, and definitely in danger. And somewhere beneath them all, in the subways, in the dark, the avatar of New York slumbers alone on a bed of trash with no one to keep him warm, no one to protect him.
Not for long, Manny vows privately. I'll find you soon.
And then, well, Manny came to New York because he no longer wanted to be what he was. The city has taken his name and his past. But only because he was willing to give those up in the first place. Perhaps he should not be ashamed that the city has laid claim to the rest as well, including the parts he thought undesirable or unsavory. Of course New York would find a use for those. No city can exist without someone like him. This city in particular cannot. And maybe it's time he accepted that. And is it so terrible to be terrible? If he puts all the awfulness of himself into the service of the city? It is unexpectedly comforting, this possibility. When he settles down to rest, he drops off to sleep almost immediately and dreams 8 million beautifully ruthless dreams. Interruption. The instant Paolo climbs out of the cab, he knows what he's seeing. The apartment building is unobtrusive in nearly every way, except that it is more Queens than any other part of the sprawling borough that Paolo has seen. It has become the locus for a city avatar's power. He can also sense the prickle of the enemy's work nearby. But somehow, unlike Inwood, this breach has done less harm. After the cab leaves,
with a substantial bill, since Paolo told the man to drive around a bit so that he could pinpoint the area of disturbed dimensional integrity. He slips down the narrow dark gap between the framework houses and hops over the chain-link fence so that he can get a better look at the site. An aging plastic above-ground pool. It has the same pale acrid scent as whatever infected the monument rock at Inwood. More power has been applied here, decisively and precisely, excising the infection with a surgical efficiency that Paolo cannot help but reluctantly admire. Between this and its proximity to the apartment building locus, and possibly other factors that Paolo cannot fathom, it seems unlikely that this site will attract hangers-on. He hears a voice calling in Chinese to someone else within the house, and quickly he exits the backyard. At the apartment building, he presses the buzzer for the topmost apartment, meaning to work his way down. When an indistinct feminine voice, fuzzy with feedback, murmurs through the intercom speaker, he says, "I'm looking for someone who knows about what happened to the pool in the backyard next door." There is a pause. Then the voice says again indistinctly,
"Are you one of those fuckers from ICE? We are here legally, and whichever fucker reported us can go to hell."
"I'm most definitely not with ICE, the police, or any organization you've ever heard of." Paolo steps back onto the building's walkway so that anyone looking out the window can get a good look at him in the walkway lighting. He sees someone at the window, but they're there and gone too quickly for him to discern. Going back to the intercom, he debates whether to ring the apartment doorbell again or move on to the next floor. Then there is another indistinct murmur through the speaker, and the building's front door buzzes to let him in. On the fourth floor, a plump 40-something woman in a sari cracks open the door to peer at him, without bothering to take the chain lock off. Paolo can see a middle-aged man in the background, on his feet and scowling belligerently, with a baby's feeding bottle in one fist. The woman is defensive too, but Paolo understands this. Everyone is wary of strangers in a city. Her gaze rakes him as he reaches the top landing of the stairs.
"You don't have permission to enter," she says at once.
"I only want to speak. I can stand right here and do that."
This makes her relax, fractionally.
"What now?"
she asks in accented, annoyed English.
"Are you a reporter? I heard that someone mentioned it on Twitter, but it's still hard to believe you come about a pool. It's the middle of the night." "My name is Sao Paulo," he says, expecting it to mean nothing to her.
Most of the Americans he meets have never even heard of him, or else they think he's part of California.
"I'm looking for..."
Her gasp catches him by surprise.
"They said... Oh, you're real?"
He lifts an eyebrow.
"Quite real, yes."
There's only one reason she would ask such a question.
"You've seen things that aren't real lately?"
She shrugs.
"Craziness. Everywhere in this city. But most recently next door, yesterday. Other people came who talked about the craziness. They were like you."
She narrows her eyes at Paolo then, as if trying to discern something she cannot articulate.
"I don't know." "Other people? One was... Manny. I think that was the name. The other was Brooklyn Thomason, one of those city council people. Tall and black, both of them. Fair man and dark woman. They said our Padmini was Queens."
They've begun to find each other, even without his help. Paolo can't help smiling.
"When they've left, can you tell me where?"
She tilts her head, thoughtful, and her gaze is suddenly shrewd. The man in the background has come forward and now stands just behind her, and their stances are alike, subtly protective. The man follows the woman's lead, however, and the woman says,
"Why you to ask then? They said something was hunting them. Someone. A woman."
Paolo's skin prickles all over, as it did at the Inwood Rock and by the suspicious swimming pool. Could the enemy have reactualized harbingers already? It is as if the birthing battle did nothing.
"That should not be," he says slowly and softly. "But hunting. Yes, I believe that's true."
New cities usually had very healthy survival instincts because they had to. If the avatars of New York believed that a hostile foreign presence was hunting them down, they were probably right.
"A woman, you said?"
Her mouth pulls to one side.
"I suppose you're not a woman. Still, why should I tell you anything?"
"Because I'm here to help them."
"Lot of good you've done so far."
Paolo inclines his head in acknowledgement of this. It's not an apology.
"Truthfully, there isn't much I can do,"
he says.
"My task is to advise. In the end, the battle is theirs to fight and survive. But I can even advise them if I can find them. And any knowledge at this stage will help. They need every bit of help they can get."
The woman considers this. Paolo thinks his honesty has helped. She doesn't have a high opinion of him, but at least it's marginally positive. Her husband murmurs in her ear in some other language, and even without translating the words, Paolo can recognize a "don't tell him anything, we don't know who this man is." The woman nods a little, but there is a sad look on her face as she regards Paolo again.
"I can't help her either,"
she says at last.
"She's my cousin's daughter, smart girl, good, pretty when she bothers to try. But they sent her here alone, can you believe it? It was all they could afford, and only us to look after her."
"She has more people to help her now,"
Paolo says, as gently as he can. Her concern is genuine. He can't reassure her, sadly. If this woman's cousin is indeed the Avatar of Queens, then she is in terrible danger and might not survive. But Paolo can be truthful about this much.
"The city is never alone, not really. And this city seems less solitary than most. More like a family. Many parts, frequently squabbling. But in the end, against enemies, they come together and protect one another. They must or die."
The woman is watching him now, sorrow giving way to fascination.
"There are 5 other people out there who will be this for her. 6, if you let me help."
After a long moment, she sighs.
"Oh, they were tired. Hungry. They went to Brooklyn, with Brooklyn, to rest for the night."
They should not be either tired or hungry. Nothing about this city's birth is going as it should. Paolo restrains a sigh and says,
"That could be good. If they know how to create protective loci."
He glances around at the walls of the apartment building's corridor, seeing more than the ugly wood paneling. In a place protected in this manner, they would be proof against attack. Safer together than they could ever be with Paolo. He nods to himself.
"Then the 3 of them can take care of one another for now. But that leaves 2 alone.
The Bronx, Staten Island.
They said they would go to the Bronx in the morning. It sounded like they had an idea of where to look."
It leaves the Avatar of the Bronx to fend for themselves until then.
But if the others have some inkling of the Avatar's location, then they're doing better at tracking each other down than Paolo is.
What of Staten Island?
What about it?
The woman looks skeptical now.
They said they didn't know how to find that one.
Staten Island is the smallest borough, according to Wikipedia. Geographically vast, but only a few hundred thousand people in population. There's a chance that Paolo might find the Avatar simply by going there and driving around if he rents a car. Cities, even small ones, make a weight upon the world. With enough proximity, one can feel the pull they exert.
Then I'll begin there, Paolo says.
He reaches into a lapel pocket, past the half-empty pack of cigarettes, and pulls out a business card. Polish Danus are infamous workaholics. Other Brazilians joke about their obsession with meetings and office politics and all the trappings of business. There is a touch of power in the card when he hands it to her, but he does not attempt to expend that power. She's not one of his, after all, and Queens is likely to take it poorly if Paolo gets pushy with her relatives. He merely says,
"Please, give your cousin that number when you speak to her again. The country code for the call, assuming she has an American phone, would be 55.
She takes the card and frowns at it. There's nothing on it except in elegant block capitals, the words, Mr. São Paulo, and a phone number. Underneath the name, though above the number, is a smaller subhead, City Representative.
Why should she have to make an expensive international call to talk to you? Get an American phone.
Forcing others to acknowledge my point of origin provides a latent strengthening effect.
She draws back a little, utterly confused. Paolo nods to her and to her husband, then turns to go.
Is that all then? Just call you?
Yes.
Then Paolo stops at the top of the steps.
No. Tell her to text me the location of the Bronx, and I'll meet them there after I found Staten Island. They said they didn't know exactly where the Bronx. They will.
That they've managed to find each other thus far is proof that the city is helping them, however weakly, pricking their intuition, calling their attention to seemingly innocuous details or facts, guarding their places of rest. That won't be enough to keep them safe for long, but it helps. They need every bit of help they can get. The woman shakes her head, sighing.
Ah, she has studies, a job, a life. When will all of this be over?
When they find the primary Avatar,
Paolo says. But this feels like a lie. Something strange is happening in the city. Something he's never seen before, and that the others have never mentioned. No way to be certain that it will end when the city is whole, because nothing here has gone the way it should. So he amends.
I hope.
Then he heads off to track down the smallest borough. Chapter 8. No sleep in or near Brooklyn. Brooklyn tells herself that she's just crashing in the vacation unit to be polite. Padmini's stressed out, poor child, considering she only just learned about all this city business a few hours ago. And Manhattan, despite being a scary motherfucker behind that nice face of his, is still a new kid in the big city. Brooklyn tells herself that she's sticking around in case they need anything. It's a lie, though. The bed she's lying on is new, with a fancy European-style mattress and 1,000 thread-count sheets. But it's still her old bedroom. And as Brooklyn settles in to rest, having cracked open the window so she can listen to the night sounds of the city, crickets and passing cars and the soft laughter and music of a house party somewhere on the next block, she finds herself needing comfort, too. and finding it in the familiarity of the old walls, the old ceiling, the old scent of the place that's still there, ever so faintly, underneath the new paint and hardwood floors. Back in the day, her room would have been sweltering. They couldn't afford air conditioning units or the resulting electric bills, just fans. And Brooklyn would have been looking at the night sky through burglar bars, which everyone needed at the height of the crack epidemic. Still, back then she had been a teenage girl so full of dreams, whose only real worries were passing the Regents and not getting knocked up by her boyfriend at the time. What was his name? Jermaine, German, something with a J. Lord, she couldn't even remember. She hadn't yet become MC Free, vanguard of a movement. She was just a kid trying out freestyle lyrics in the dark, forgetting half the best ones because she kept falling asleep in the middle of composition. And back then, she sure hadn't been expecting to transform into a goddamn living embodiment of this wild, incredible, stupid-ass city. But there is a kind of poetry to the whole situation that Brooklyn accepts. Because this wild, incredible, stupid-ass city has given her so much. That's why she ran for city council, after all. Because she believes that only people who actually love New York versus those merely occupying and exploiting it should dictate what it is and becomes. Becoming a borough is just the literalization of something she's always done, so she's okay with it. More than she ever expected to be. She knows who it is as soon as the phone rings. "Are you coming home?" asks Jojo, in a carefully bored tone so as to let Brooklyn know she doesn't actually care. It's cool. She's 14, which she thinks is almost grown, so she absolutely, resolutely does not miss her mama. "I'm right next door, which is why I asked if you were coming home." Brooklyn sighs, although it's fond. "I told you, this place still feels like home to me, baby. Just let me have this for a little while, okay?" Jojo's sigh is almost a match for her own, but Brooklyn hears the amusement in it. "You're so weird, Mama." Then, in the background of the phone, Brooklyn hears her getting up and doing something involving a grunt and a wooden rattle. "Oh, opening her window, too. I guess you used to look out at this view and think of lyrics." "Mostly I just looked at the sky." "Did you finish that paper you were supposed to do for English?" "Yes, Mama, 5 paragraphs, just the way the SAT likes it. Sing-song boredom. I miss Ms. Fountain, who used to let us write interesting stuff." Brooklyn agrees. Jojo has gotten into one of the coveted specialized high schools of the city, Brooklyn Latin. It's a more old-fashioned school than Brooklyn likes. Actual classes in Latin, and uniforms and other stuff that would have made Brooklyn herself vomit at that age. But Jojo chose it, and she's mostly thriving there. The beloved Miss Fountain, like a lot of teachers in the city who don't want to squeeze in with roommates for the rest of their lives, decided to accept triple the pay from a Tony private school up in Westchester. And Brooklyn can't blame her one bit for that. She feels sorry for Jojo, though, and the other public school kids who've lost a good thing. "Well, that's why I proposed that program I told you about," she says to Jojo, "to help public school teachers get affordable housing." "Mm-hmm." It's not really disinterest. Jojo is usually more invested in Brooklyn's current life as a politician than she is in Brooklyn's past life as a rapper, which makes Brooklyn very happy. The girl is distracted now, though. Over the phone, there's another sound. The cell phone bumping up against a window screen. "I can't see anything." "You gotta open the screen, baby."
"Ew, Mama, mosquitoes will get in. I'll get West Nile malaria."
"Then you better kill them."
The sky over the city has too much light, baby. You can see the stars a little, but you gotta work for them. Brooklyn grins. Can't let anything stand between you and what you want.
Is this another lecture about goals? You said you were gonna stop lecturing me about goals.
It's a lecture about the stars. And also goals. There is a moment's pause while she hears JoJo rattling the screen and finally getting it up.
Ooh, I do see 3 stars in a row.
That's Orion's belt, isn't it? Probably. Now it's Brooklyn's turn to go wrestle with her bedroom window. Fortunately, she had the shitty, paint-crusted old single panes replaced during a gut renovation a few years back. The new double-paned windows are much easier to open. Once she's raised the screen and poked her head outside, she looks up. Oh, yeah. Definitely Orion. Then she looks over. The 2 buildings have flush back ends. In the dark, her daughter's silhouette waves at her, and she waves back. Then Brooklyn pauses as she notices something else in the dark. Down in the paved backyard of the other building, where her father sometimes likes to barbecue for the family. At other times of year, it's mostly just occupied by an old ironwork table and some uncomfortable chairs and a lot of dead plants in pots. Her father gets after her for those, but she's busy. Green thumbs take time she doesn't have. She keeps meaning to get a landscaping company in, have them do something interesting with the space. Right now, however, there is a strange glowing thing stretched over one corner of the yard. She leans farther out the window, frowning as she tries to figure out what that is. Did somebody string up a tangle of neon tape? Do they even make such a thing? But this does not have the slightly yellow glow of things made with luminescent dye. It's untinted white and ghostly and seems to waver a little as she looks at it, as if it isn't quite there. Then it moves. Brooklyn jerks violently, and there is a terrifying instant in which she tips a little, where she's balanced herself against the bottom windowsill in order to lean out. It would only be a 1-story fall, but people have died from less. She catches herself, fortunately, and gets a grip on the window frame, though her hand has gone sweaty and numb with chill. Because now that she's gotten a good look at it, there is something like a 3-foot-wide spider moving around the backyard that her daughter leans out over. It has only 4 legs, if those even qualify as legs. They don't taper. They don't bend as they come away from the tiny central body. The whole creature must just be lying on the ground, spread out along the concrete flagstones in a flat cross. That's all it is. But when it moves, it is vaguely spider-like, contracting into a single flat line and then scissoring out into 4 lines again, all joined at a small rounded hub. An eldritch daddy long legs brought to you by the letter X. And then another scrabbles over the chain-link fence between tendrils of her neighbor's gone wild grapevine. The creature pauses for a moment, 1 leg sticking straight up, as if to test the air. The phone is still in her hand, her mouth dry. Brooklyn pulls it back to her face. JoJo, go inside.
What?
She can see her daughter, still looking up, start a little.
Whoa!
For an instant, she loses her balance, too, and Brooklyn suffers a horrified second of fearing that she will watch her only child tumble into the backyard with those things. But JoJo catches herself, as her mother has already done, then looks around.
You see something, Mama?
Yes, go inside. Shut your window and move away from it. Better still, go to Dad's room. Get him up and in his chair.
Oh, shit.
JoJo says, and immediately darts inside. She's a smart child when she isn't being a smartass, and she is herself a true child of New York. enough to know that Brooklyn doesn't warn of danger without good reason. Under the circumstances, Brooklyn's going to overlook the profanity. The moment Jojo slides the window closed with a loud thump, the white X spiders in the backyard react, shivering and then X-ing forward a few steps. There are three now, Brooklyn sees. Another has just folded its front two legs over the lip of a wooden planter that it was apparently hidden behind. She's guessed what they are now, though. They have a different shape from the white feathers that menaced her at the 2-train station and surrounded Manhattan in Inwood Hill Park. And they feel of the same prickling, jangling antithesis of presence that everything else associated with the enemy seems to radiate. As if they erase some tiny part of New York with every iota of its space they occupy. And now there are six of them in her family's backyard. Brooklyn runs to the bedroom door and down the hall. She hears a startled snort from one of the guest rooms as her feet drum down the corridor, Manhattan waking from sleep. Can't wait for him to help, for whatever good he'd be. She's only wearing satin pajamas, no shoes, and carrying no gun. Not the